Thank you. So I guess I should start by thanking the organizer for inviting me to give a talk here. And first of all, this is joint work with Guillaume Aubrun from Lyon. And well, it's about LOC transformations and entanglement catalysis. So let me start just by giving a brief overview of LOCC transformations. So the physical setup is as follows. You have Alice and Bob, which are separate, and they share a pure bipartite state, phi AB, which is a vector, which is a norm one vector in the tensor product, HA tens HB. So I shall be assuming always that Hilbert spaces are finite dimensional. And well, what they want to do is they want to transform their initial state phi into another state phi, with the constraint that they should use only local operations and classical communications, right? Because otherwise that's always possible. If you allow global operations, that's always possible. So we ask that they should only use local operations. So what do I mean by local operations? Well, local unitaries. So Alice acts with a unitary UA on her system, and Bob with a unitary UB on his system. So unitaries that decompose as a product, and local measurements, right? So again, observables which tensorize. Okay. And the question we ask is, given two states, phi and psi, is it possible for Alice and Bob to realize such a transformation? So starting with phi, is it possible at the end of the protocol they end up with psi? Okay. Oh, I missed my start. Next time we'll do better. Okay, so how does this work? It was the necessary and sufficient conditions for such transformations, for such LOCC transformations, were found by Michael Nielsen. And the conditions, in fact, we start by giving two Schmidt decompositions for the pure state vectors psi and psi. So we write them as usual Schmidt decompositions. Here I assume that that phi and psi are vectors in a d-dimensional Hilbert space. And well, the condition Nielsen found is that the transformation phi gives psi is possible if and only if the Schmidt vector x of phi is majorized by the Schmidt vector of psi. So the initial Schmidt vector is majorized by the final Schmidt vector. I shall tell you in a moment what this relation is. And let me just point out that in this theorem, in fact, there are only the Schmidt vectors x and y intervene. The other quantities here, the pure states a b c and d, do not intervene, because obviously Alice and Bob can just do local operations and change whatever basis elements are here. So only the Schmidt vectors appear in the theorem. Okay. Now, how do let me talk about this domination, this majorization relation. So it is defined. It is a relation. It is a binary relation on the set of probability vectors. Of here, I shall not be set by PZ, and of course I shall always be using these inclusions. So a d-dimensional vector will be seen as an element of d plus one dimensional vectors just by appending a zero component at the end. And the majorization relation is defined in terms of the decreasing rearrangements of vectors. So I take a vector x and I rearrange its components decreasingly. And the relation is defined via partial sums. So we say that x is dominated or majorized by y if the sum of the k largest component of x is smaller than or equal than the sum of the k largest components of y. Okay. And As I said, this relation is a partial on PD, and it has a minimal element. It is the constant vector. So I'm using probability vectors, sorry, normalized vectors. So all the components are equal to 1 over z. And the maximal elements, there are z of them, and there are the vectors 1, 0, and its permutation. So the vectors with a 1 in a particular position. And, well, these are vectors. Recall that the Nielsen theorem states the possibility of a given LOC transformation in terms of Schmidt vectors. So these vectors correspond to Schmidt vectors for a bipartite pure state. This one, in fact, it corresponds to a maximum entangled state, right? So what Nielsen's theorem is saying that is that if Alice and Bob start with a pure maximal entangled state, well, then they can obtain anything at the end, because, you know, when starting with maximal entanglement, then at the end you can get whatever you want. Well, the other way around, if Alice and Bob start with a separable state, that is, if the initial state is phi, let me just write it down here. If the initial state is phi A tensor B, then the Schmidt vector is 1, 0, 0. And then obviously, since they are allowed only local operations and classical communications, they can only obtain separable states, right? So this amount saying that this vector here is a maximal element for this order, right? So starting from this one, you can only get this one. Starting from separable states, you can only end up with separable states. Okay, so this domination relation is very well understood. It was introduced in linear algebra in the 50s to study eigenvalue inequalities for matrices. And there are several equivalent characterizations for this relation. Let me just point out the last one, maybe. So a vector X, so the set of vectors which are dominated by a given vector Y, I shall denote this set by SD of Y. Well, this is a contact set. And we know its extremal points. Its extremal points are the vector Y and the vectors obtained by permuting the coordinates of Y. Right, so like in the three-dimensional case for D equals 3, this is P3, which is a two-dimensional convex set. Well, this, the set SD of Y is something like this. Here you have Y. You take all the permutations of Y, the vectors obtained by permuting the coordinates of Y, and you get SD of Y. Okay. And another important feature of this relation is that it behaves well with respect to tensor products. So if I have two elements x1 which is smaller than y1 and the same thing for x2 and y2, then when I take tensor products of the left hand side, I get an element which is smaller than the tensor product of the right hand side. And well, from an operational point of view, this is saying that if Alice and Bob can transform phi1 into psi1 and phi2 into psi2, then they can do the same thing for phi1 times phi2, and they can transform it into to psi1 times phi2, just by doing tensor products of whatever operation they did earlier. And this is this thing can prove it very easily, starting with number 3 here, with the property number 3 here, just by tensorizing B1 and B2, right? By choosing a matrix B, which is B1 tensor B2, when B1 achieves this and B2 achieves this. Okay. And, well, one will ask if there is a converse to this statement. Well, it's obvious that when I say converse, I don't mean anything in particular, but can we talk about a converse of this statement? And the answer is more or less no. The converse is false, and I shall define what I mean by converse in two situations. What's commonly known as entanglement catalysis and multiple copy transformations. Okay. Notice that I gave up on switching the other. Okay, so let me now talk about entanglement catalysis, which is the main topic of my talk. So, in 1998, Jonathan and Plenio they noticed that a very interesting phenomenon occurs, is that entanglements can help LHC transformations without being consumed. So, what does that mean? I mean that there is these states phi and psi, so biparted pure state. I'm always talking about biparted pure state, phi and psi, such that the transformation phi gives psi is not possible, so Alice and Bob cannot possibly do this, but they can do it with the help of a catalyst state, a state chi. So phi psi is not possible, but phi times chi gives psi times chi is possible, becomes possible, right? So I call this a converse to the previous statement, right? Because what you can do is just simplify chi, but this doesn't work, right? And now, from a probability vector point of view, what I'm saying is that there are probability vectors x, y, such that x is not smaller than y, and x times z is smaller than y times z. Well, and this such phenomena can occur, in fact, in a fairly small dimension. So here I have d equals 4, and I use a two-dimensional catalyst. So this is not very exotic. I mean, you can find examples fairly easily. And well, in order to understand such situation, I introduced a new relation. Well, not me. It was already been introduced by Nielsen, I think, which is called trumping. He called it trumping. And I said that the vector x is trumped by a vector y, and I added t here in the relation. If there is a catalyst vector z, such that x times z is smaller than y times z. Okay, thank you. Okay, and well, there is another phenomenon which resembles this one, which is called multiple copy LHC transformations. And the point here is that, well, maybe that phi cannot be transformed into psi, but several copies of phi can be transformed in the same number of copies of psi, right? So here I'm not using a catalyst state, I'm just using multiple times the initial and the final state. And this is called multiple copy catalysis or transformations. Well, I have a similar characterization with probability vectors, just restating what I said before. And well, again, there are examples which are fairly simple. Here you have the same vectors as before, and x is not smaller than y, x squared is not smaller than y squared, but x tensored 3 times is smaller than y tensored 3 times. So again, this phenomenon occurs at fairly low dimensions. And as before, I introduce another relation on a PD. I say that x is MLOCC measurized by y if there is an integer n such that x tensorized with itself n times is smaller than y tensor n. Okay. And now, well, one would want to understand those new relations. So, the smaller with a t and an m. And as I did for FD, I introduced similar sets. So TD will be the set of vectors which are trumped by y, and MD again is defined in a similar fashion. So it is a set of vectors for which there exist powers such that x times n is smaller than y times n. And here we have some nice characterization of SD, and one would like to have, well, nice characterizations for these two sets. Okay. Well, one fact is obvious, is that, well, the set here, the set SD, which is simply, I call that it is a set of vectors x which are smaller than y, so no catalyst and no power. Well, it is, of course, it is a subset of MD, just here take n equals 1. And a fun fact is that MD is a substitute of TD. And this can be seen just by using this catalyst here. Well, when you do the computations, you'll find out that this simplifies them. There are some simplifications and it works. Right? So this is like, this is fairly easy to check out. So M is smaller than T. And now, T is convex. I can show that T is convex. However, I think we don't know if M is convex. And an important fact is that, well, when looking at the definition of T and M, you see that there are two parameters. In the definition of T, you have the size, the dimension of the catalyst, the K here. And here you have the M, right? The power up, the power you need to go up in order to have this relation. And, well, for general Y, well, there is no upper bound on the integers K and N you have to use, right? So these sets are really complicated by saying that, well, you have to look at an infinite number of conditions of catalyst dimensions here or of powers here in order to give a characterization of them. And also, this is quite strange. N and T are not closed sets. Well, simply because they are defined via an infinite number of closed conditions, right? So there is no reason for them to be closed. Okay, so the point here is that, well, one would like to understand these two sets, and well, since they are not closed, one would like to understand their closure, which are, say, physically relevant. And also it is not clear. Well, we have this inclusion here, but maybe that the closures are equal. Maybe that the two types of catalysis are more like equivalent up to closures. We know that they are not. We know that there are vectors Y for which this inequality is strict. This inclusion is strict, but maybe that the closures are equal. So this problem. This problem was for some time an important one in quantum information. Let me present some results. Oh, right. So first of all, I should talk about LP norms, right? And well, a function f from the vectors of size d into reals is said to be sure convex. If it is a monotone with respect to the majorization relation, and well, we have some examples of sure convex functions. These are the LP norms. Here I take a power of the LP norms, and I define them for all p's, right? Not only for a p larger than one. So they are not norms. I call them LP norms, but they are not norms. And for every real P, I define this quantity. And this, of course, these quantities are related to the Reni entropies by this simple formula. So basically, I could have given this talk only talking about Reni entropies, but somehow it is easier to talk about LP norms. And these functions are sure convex for all p's except the p's between 0 and 1, where the functions are sure concave. So minus np is sure convex for p between 0 and 1. And since we are interested with tensor products, these functions have an interesting property that they are multiplicative with respect to tensor products. Right. If I take the NP norm, NP quantity of a tensor product, just get the product of the NP quantities of the respective vectors. And if X is in one of the sets MD or TD, then just by using this property, this multiplicativity property, and by simplifying here, for instance, if I take X into TD, I just write NP of X times Z is more than NP of Y times Z, because the NP function is sure convex, And then I just, using the multiplicativity, I can just simplify the NP of Z, and I get this inequality, right? So this one is for sure convex, for the sure convex case, and the other one is when the function is a sure concave, right? So for every vector in these two sets, I have this kind of inequalities. And Nielsen asks if these inequalities are enough to characterize the closures of these two sets. So there are necessary conditions for vector X to be inside M or T. The question is, are they sufficient conditions? Okay. Now, you may say this is not such a nice characterization of the sets of these two sets as the one you had for FD. But however, notice that we have quantities which are of physical relevance, and starting from conditions on these quantities, you may say whether or not a vector is in M or T. Now, let me say the main results on the subject. So I start with the vector y, which is three-dimensional. So I shall emphasize each time that the dimensions I put here are very important in what follows. So I start with the vector which is d-dimensional and which doesn't have any zero components. So all the coordinates of y are strictly positive. And we have the three necessary conditions for a vector x to be inside one of M or C of y. Well, the first result we proved is that if I assume only the first condition, so if I assume only the inequalities for p larger than one, then the vector x x may be not in M D of y, but it is in the closure of some union of, it is in these sets. Well, these sets may look awful, but they are not. What I'm saying is that, So y is in PD, right? So when I'm saying that x, say, is in M, what I'm saying is that there exists a sequence xn which converges to x, xn in Pn. Is there a way to... So what I'm saying is that I can approximate x by a sequence xn which lives in Pn, so the size of xn will be larger than the size of x, such that, x, say I do it for m, xn is in mn of y. Right, so here I'm talking about mn of y. What this means is that I'm starting with a d-dimensional vector y, and I'm appending the number of zeros I have to in order to see y as an element of Pn. Okay, so I have an approximating sequence xn, which lives in large dimensional probability simplices Pn, such that for each n, xn is MNOCT dominated by y when y is seen as an n-dimensional vector, and xn converges to x, in the obvious way. Okay. For all P, yeah. Oh, yeah. For all P. Yeah, it's not implicit. Yeah, of course. So the conditions here are for all P. Yeah, thank you. Well, this was our first result. And when later we found that if we had the second condition, so the condition on the P norms for all P between 0 and 1, then we can do a little better. then we can choose this sequence, Xn, not in Pn, but in Pd plus 1. So we need only to add one component, one zero component to Y, and then we can find an approximating sequence for X, which is only one component larger, which is in Md of Y. And the same holds for Td. And some months later, Turgot proved the result in, at least half of the result. That is when considering all three conditions, all three conditions are equivalent to X being an element of the closure of Td. Now, let me just.
Are only closures L1?
Here the closures are in a PD plus 1. Because now I'm only working in a finite dimension, right? Because here these sets are like infinite dimensional. Here the problem is much simpler. And now let me just talk about this Turgot's result. Well, first of all, his result is it doesn't say anything about the set M, whereas our result, we start with the set M, and then it is an easy corollary that the same works for T, because T is larger. So we deal with the set M. Well, Turgot's result only works for T. So first of all, this leaves open the question whether the closure of Td is equal to the closure of Md. And well, it doesn't say anything about M. And well, you shall see later in my talk why our method cannot say anything about the condition C, and why there was no hope for getting the whole result. Okay, so I have until
about 20 more minutes.
About 20 more minutes. Okay. Now let me move on to the proof. So the main idea of the proof, which was not ours, we seen this idea in a paper of Cooperberg, of Greg Cooperberg. Well, it was a paper on quantum information, but not on the same subject. So maybe this idea can be useful in other fields in quantum information. Is that we started by looking at probability vectors, right? So we started looking on axes in PD, and Cooperberg's idea was to associate to such a vector a probability measure mu of x, which is simply a convex combination of direct masses. And well, the point here is that the direct points where I put the mass here are logarithms of the coordinates. So there is some kind of correlation between the mass xy and the position where this mass is, which is important. And this way you get a probability measure, right? And let's see two examples. Well, for the maximal element for the majorization order 100, well, you get the Dirac mass in zero, because you only get the one contribution, and you get a mass of one into the at the point log of one. And as for the minimal element, you get a direct mass at minus log of d, which is like far to the left for d large. And I shall also define a random variable which has this law, which has this probability law, so which is equal to log of xy with probability xy. I call this vx. And now I should introduce another relation, this time a relation on probability measures. So let me consider two probability measures, mu and nu, and I say that mu is stochastically dominated by nu if I have this, which tells me more or less that the mass mu gives to large values to the segment T infinity of the real axis is always smaller than the same quantity for nu. So basically, more or less, what it says is that mu gives less mass to large values than nu. And there is an equivalent characterization of this relation. That is that I can construct random variables x and y, which have the respective law of mu and u, such that x is smaller than y almost surely. Okay, so here the smaller is the usual smaller relation on the real numbers. So basically, mu is smaller than u if I can come up with random variables which have these laws, and such that one is smaller than the other. It's a very natural relation on probability measures. Okay, so now let me show you how this. Maybe I should keep the theorems on the right hand side for the moment. Let me show you how this this connects with what I've said before. And well, the idea now is I have found a way to associate probability measures to vectors, and I have maybe I can find a link. A connection between these two relations, the majorization relation and the stochastic domination. Well, there are two facts which work in our favor. Is that, first of all, this application which to a vector we associate a probability measure, well, it behaves well with respect to tensor products. So when I take the measure associated to a tensor product, x tends y, I get the convolution product of the probability measures, which is very cool because we can see this application as a morphism between probability vectors with the operation of tensor product and probability measures with the usual convolution operation. Well, the convolution operation means that, well, just right here. So if, let's say, if x has distribution mu and y has distribution mu, and if x and y are independent, so this is denoted by this, then x plus y has distribution. The distribution of the sum is the convolution product, right? So this is the basic definition of convolution on probability measures. So this is one very important point for us because we will be looking at tensor products of vectors. So this has a nice analog for probability measures. And the second one is that, well, this relation I've just introduced, the stochastic domination, for the associated measures implies the majorization for the initial vectors. Okay? So now, what is the idea behind this is, well, what I'll be doing from now on is that I will forget about vectors and about the majorization relation. I shall only be looking at probability measures, convolution and stochastic domination. At the end, I will prove a result on stochastic domination, and then I will get the analogous result on majorization using this implication. Well, there is a downside to this, and the problem is that this doesn't work in the other way. This doesn't work the other way. The two relations are not equivalent. Stochastic domination is strictly stronger than majorization, and in particular, if you have this, if the measure associated to x is stochastically dominated by the measure associated to y, then you do get, this implies that the size of x, the size of the vector x, is strictly larger than the size of the vector y, and this is like very inconvenient because, well. Recall here, our results only dealt with vectors x approximating x, which were always larger in size than the initial vector. So, because of this condition, since we only will be reasoning on probability measures, we cannot hope to get results on vectors x which have the same size of the vector y, simply because we have this.
The size, the number of non-zero.
Exactly, the size of the support of the. Thank you. So this is the reason. This is the reason why our approach to the problem, using these measures and probability theory results, will never be able to produce such results. Where here you have this basically the same size for x and for y. Now maybe I can move on and Okay, so another parallel between the two points of view, between the probability vector point of view and probability measures, is that, well, LP norms correspond to exponential moments or to Laplace transforms. So how does this work? Well, recall that to a vector x, I have associated the measure mu x and the random variable vx, which has the law mu x. And, well, there is this relation, between the p plus 1 norm of x, of the vector x, and the mean the pth exponential moment of the random variable vx. Okay, so since we have inequalities on the NP quantities for the vector x, this corresponds to inequalities on these quantities for vx on ux, which is basically the same thing. That's what I'm seeing here. And well, the tool from probability theory we will be using to prove our theorems is Kramer's large deviation theorem, which has a statement that may look scary, but it is not. Basically, what it's saying is that, consider a random variable x, let's say a finite random variable which is not too nested, which is small, such that all these quantities are finite. And consider also IID copies of x. And you know, by the law of the large numbers, that x1 plus etc. plus xn divided by n will always converge to the expectation of x. And what does this theorem tell you is that, well, if what is the probability that the mean of the first n samples of the law x is far from the expectation? And basically it tells you that this probability is exponential small. It behaves like exponential of minus n times something. And this something is this quantity here, lambda star, capital lambda star of t, which can be computed in principle starting with the distribution of x. Okay? So this is the tool, this is the main tool for probability theory we shall be using later on. And from this theorem we can prove a rather simple corollary of the theorem, is that, well, if you consider two random variables x and y, well, you may think of x and y as vx for probability vector x and vy for probability vector y. So these are